Good morning. This is April 10th, 2000, here in Natick, Massachusetts. This is part of the Morse Institute Library Continuing Veterans Oral History Project. And this morning, we are privileged to have with us Herbert Ross. Good morning, Herbert. How are you?
Good morning, John. I'm going to call you Herb,
a little less formal. May I start out by asking you your age?
I'm 77.
77 years old, and your current address?
Wayland.
And your marital status?
I'm married.
Married. Do you have children?
Yes, I have five.
Five children?
Five children.
I get asked then, do you have grandchildren?
I have three.
Three grandchildren.
Right.
You've got a good life. Herb, where were you born?
Belfast, Northern Ireland.
How did you come to be born in Belfast?
Well, my mother and father both lived there at that time. They're both native Northern Irish. My father emigrated in 1925 to this country, and we followed him in 1927.
So you are an immigrant?
I'm an immigrant.
Good for you.
Yeah, I made it.
Good for you. Where were you raised after your family came here?
I was raised in Boston, particularly in Dorchester and Jamaica Plain.
Is that where your family, your dad lived?
Dad lived and worked in those areas.
What kind of work did he do?
He was a store manager for a now defunct butter and egg or creamery store, Kennedy's.
Oh,
Ames.
Sure. Yeah.
I'm sure you remember them from the 30s and the 40s.
Yeah. Yeah. And what did your mom do?
She was a homemaker. She never...
With five children?
No, just with me. I was a single child. No others.
Oh, that's right. You're the one that had five children.
I was the one.
Excuse me. What's your affinity with Natick? Did the family move out here or...
No, I came out here to work in a Kennedy store, which was on Main Street at that time in 1948. I come out here that...
Did you move to Natick?
Yes, I moved. Yeah. I married that May in 1948, and I moved into Natick.
And where did you meet your bride?
I met her in Boston.
And
we worked together.
Was she Irish as well?
She's an Irish-American, yes.
That's great. What was Natick like when you got here? You got here in 1948.
It was more as it was, I guess, from the 20s and the 30s. It was very a neighborhood town.
Mm-hmm. Where in town did you live?
I lived on Plain Street.
Okay.
And you could very easy to know, working on Main Street, to know the people in the town at that time, because the population was more centered in Natick.
Did you walk to work every morning?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
I had no car, I think, at that time at all.
And what was traffic like?
Much lighter.
Much lighter. You could actually make a left turn.
Yeah, there was no one-way streets.
Yeah. Was it from Natick that you entered the military?
No, I entered it from Jamaica Plain.
Tell us about that now. How did you come to go into the military?
Well, I was a British citizen in 1941, 1942, and I attempted to volunteer for the Canadian Army and the Royal Air Force. And I was refused because they didn't at that time want to interfere with the American draft process. So I was drafted in March of 1943.
When you were drafted in 43, did you have a choice as to what branch of service you were going to?
Yes, I did.
And you chose?
My father was in the Army, so I thought I should be I should be in the Army.
Okay. Did you give any thought to the other services other than your
Not enough.
Historic? Not enough. Okay, you're in the Army in March of 43. Did you go into Boston and you were shipped out of there?
Yes, we were brought into Commonwealth Avenue, I remember, I think. And from there, we went to Camp Devens.
You said we. Did anybody else join with you?
Yes, it was a group left from the local draft board, maybe 20 or 25.
Well, I mean, any personal friends in this group, people?
I went to school with two or three of them, yes.
Yeah.
I remember there. I have the draft order yet at home.
Was this high school friends?
Yes, high school friends from Jamaica Plain.
And you all decided you're going to get drafted, so you went together?
No, I think it was just as it happened. We just was coincidence they were with me.
Okay. Whereabouts in Boston did you collect at that time?
I think in Commonwealth Avenue. There was a building
up
there.
Up at the Armory there?
I can't really remember the building.
Yeah, well, okay.
Possibly the Armory.
And what happened to you then? You were sworn in and you're in the Army.
Right.
Now.
We were sworn in previously when we were physically examined. And they let you have a week off, put you on leave for a week and brought you back. And from there you went to Camp Devens.
Now,
they were sworn in initially.
What did your family think about this? They were Irish.
Yeah.
They came over here to America and their son's going into the military services. What did they think about this?
Well, my father was in the British Army during World War I.
Yeah.
And it seemed a matter of fact to him.
It was the thing to
do. The thing to do.
Yeah. What did your mom think?
She was accepted it very well. You know, of course, she's seen her brothers were in the war. And I think they were used to seeing men leave for wars.
I think you just said you were sent to Fort Devens.
Yes.
What happened to you there?
We were just equipped there, clothing, a physical examination, and waiting to be sent out to a unit.
This being sent out to a unit, were you given tests, or how did they decide who would go where?
I think they just, where they needed you.
Luck of the draw kind of thing?
Luck of the draw, I think, yeah. And that's what happened to us, I believe, that group at Camp Devens, they were forming a new armored division, so they were sent as a group, I think the majority of us.
Did you have any druthers? Did you hope that they would send you to do something other than going into whatever you wound up in?
There was no choice, I think. And I would have, of course, you would have preferred to be at a unit that would be less arduous. But we just accepted it.
Now, did you say you were sent to an armored division?
Yes.
What is an armored division?
Armored division is principal a mixture of engineers, tanks, and infantry.
And where were you sent to?
We were sent to Camp Polk in Louisiana.
That's a long way out of Boston. Had you ever been out of Boston before or traveled?
I think the farthest I'd ever been out of Boston before was maybe New Hampshire.
So this was your first choice, your first opportunity to see the Deep South?
Yes.
Did you go down on a train?
We went down on a troop train.
What was that like?
Terrible.
Right.
The conditions weren't, you know, food.
Yeah.
And it was a coach cars, old coach cars. And it was a long, difficult trip.
Okay, you're in Camp Polk, Louisiana, and you step off the train.
And you're just immediately taken to, brought to a company area. And of course, you're broken up into units. And I was assigned to headquarters and headquarters company of the 36th Armored Regiment, which was part of this new 8th Armored Division.
And with the fellows that went down with you or that you had been together with in Boston?
I think they were dispersed.
So you're pretty much on your own now?
Very much on your own,
okay.
Yes.
Now, what kind of training did you get there?
Well, we went through an 8-week basic training course and familiarity with weapons, vehicles, military drill, and it lasted that entire time. The most of it was on vehicles, based on the use of the vehicles and their weapons.
What kind of weapons?
Well, we had the medium tank, the Sherman, which was a 75-millimeter gun, and the light tank, which had a 37-millimeter gun. And we're given courses in the which I was mechanically deficient. I'd never had a car. My family never had a car, so I was at the bottom of the list for driving or for, you know, mechanical aptitude.
Did you deal more with the weapons on the tank?
I think more of the handling of them, the driving of them.
You were driving a tank around now?
Yeah, a light tank. I done for a small amount of driving on it. And vehicles, you'd be on the large, the Jeeps and the large trucks and the half tracks, which we had.
What about infantry weapons? You were not in the infantry.
No, we didn't have infantry weapons.
Okay, so they didn't hand you a Garand or a Springfield?
No, we were handed a carbine or a submachine gun as part of the armored force.
Rising or Thompson?
At that time, it was Thompson.
Mm-hmm.
And later, it became what we call the grease gun. It was a tinny-looking affair.
Yeah. If I'm following you correctly, you're up to about June of 43 now?
They sent us down immediately. We were down there.
Well, you say that you were there for 8 weeks.
Yeah.
And you're down in the summer now, aren't
you? Yes.
Yeah. What was that like for you from out of Boston?
Oh, it was terrible. You know, the humidity and the heat, especially with vehicles, with tanks.
And this was basic training, so you're not about to get much liberty or furlough time.
No, there was no furloughs and no liberties, no 3-day passes, nothing of that. The closest we got to recreation was the post exchange.
Yeah. So you can go in and buy your Zippo lighter.
And buy your soft drinks.
Yeah. What did you like or dislike about what was happening to you down there?
I think just the conditions, you know, being new to me, being under a discipline, being under the thumb of non-commissioned officers, because they made it very basic, their treatment of you.
They gave you a hard time?
They would give you a hard
time. It was pretty tough for you?
Get pretty tough, yeah.
The military, you understood pretty well that you were going to be shipped out somewhere sometime. Did the military, the United States Army, prepare you for any of the cultural differences you might be facing? I don't think you knew at this time if you'd go to Europe or the Pacific, but did they say to you you're going to be with different people?
No.
No, nothing like that?
All.
What about your equipment? Do you feel you were happy?
I think we're adequately equipped.
Good stuff,
yeah,
good clothing?
Good stuff. Good clothing, yes.
Good food and camp there?
I would call it fair. I think the people that cooked had never cooked before. I think the only cook was the mess sergeant who didn't actually cook. But the rest of them were just rushed in to fill the places.
Yeah. Did your duties change at any time throughout your military career? Or what you were learning now is basically what you did?
Oh, yes. They trained radically, changed radically.
Okay, well, we'll get to that as we go along. Where did you go? You were there 8 weeks now in Louisiana?
Yes, that was the start of it, yes.
Okay, where did you go from there?
We stayed there. We made that camp. We were at that camp till we were sent overseas.
Okay.
From March, roughly in March of 1943 till May of 1944. And
you were there more than a year?
Yes.
Was training all this time?
But what happened was the armored division was reformed. They went from a regimental basis to a battalion basis. And we were shrunken out of that division and to form a separate tank battalion.
Why did that happen? Is that something that the military felt that was better to do?
Yeah, they must have learned that by experience they could handle their battalions much better in combat than they could a regiment. And so the all armored divisions were reformed on battalion basis instead of regimental basis. And we were the extras, and we were formed into a separate tank battalion.
Did you go on anything that, I guess the books refer to as maneuvers? Did you take off and the Red Army against the Blue Army?
Yes, we did.
Tell us about that.
Well, I think we spent more time cooperating with each other as a unit. I don't remember any large-scale as a tank battalion, any large-scale involvement of infantry units. We formed, from the battalion, we formed the opposing units facing each other. And we were out on field problems in the Louisiana maneuver area during that period, but never with large-scale infantry units.
Okay. Early newsreels that you and I have both seen that go back to 40 or early 41 show soldiers out there with broomsticks and a truck that was on the side of it was labeled tank. Did you have your full equipment at this time?
Oh, yes, we did.
And modern equipment?
1943, we did. We We did of the all the we had the half tracks, the vehicles of all, you know, tanks. We had all of that. We have no imitation equipment or vehicles.
Did you hear what was going on in the rest of the war where you were?
I think it was very limited what we heard. We didn't have individual radios, and there was no, I don't remember any newspapers circulating, not even a army newspaper. So we had a very limited information about what was going on.
By 43, the Americans had invaded North Africa and had done very badly, as you recall,
right,
in the Battle of the Kasserine Pass.
Yes.
Because our tanks and equipment were inferior to what they were up
right
against. Did you see any reaction to that in what you had?
I felt myself that knowing the tank itself, the Sherman, I thought it was a tank that wasn't advanced enough for the time we were in. I think the especially the Germans had much better tanks. I couldn't understand the ones that they used in North Africa. There's so many of those Grants with the side turret.
Mm-hmm.
And even the Sherman with his high profile. I thought they were we were behind in the design and the construction of tanks. But I think there was no general comment on it at all. I don't remember any.
Well, I guess my question is also, did you see any change in the equipment? Did the Americans produce a Model 2 or a Model 3?
No, not basically. They didn't change that Sherman until the very, I remember, late in the war, until they put a new gun into it. They put a 90-millimeter gun in when we were preparing mm-hmm. for Japan.
90-millimeter?
Yes. They took the 75-millimeter out. But the tank itself, I don't think, changed at all in our experience in the Pacific.
Okay, we're up to where in 1944 now?
We're up to when we're leaving for the Pacific.
Okay, about what month is this?
About May of 1944.
May of 44. You get orders one day to stand by, you're going to be shipped out.
You're going to be shipped
as
out.
As a battalion.
As a unit.
Okay. Where did you go?
We went to San Francisco, to Camp Stoneman, actually, in Pittsburgh, California.
And how long were you there?
I think we were only there a couple of weeks by the time they went through the process of giving us the shots and just that in that time period.
Did you get any opportunity to see San Francisco?
Yes, I was in San Francisco for one day.
One day.
Yeah.
All right. Is it possible to load a battalion on a single ship?
Yes. We loaded onto a Dutch freighter called the Boschfontein. And we were alone.
You sailed out alone?
We sailed out alone.
No convoy?
No convoy.
And where did you land?
We landed at Oro Bay in New Guinea.
No stops on the way?
We stopped at Milne Bay, which is on the eastern tip of New Guinea.
Tell us about that now. You're on the deck of a ship. And
it looks very wonderful, the shoreline. You know, it's the waving trees and the sand and the water, the colors of the water. It looked very reasonable from the looking back on the ads for Hawaii and the West Indies.
Had you been told where you were going?
No, we weren't told.
You didn't know when you saw that land come up what it was?
I don't think we were told at all. It was just a Pacific destination we came into.
Okay, did you feel you were going into direct contact with the enemy?
We knew that we weren't going to go into direct contact with the enemy at that point. That was going to be a staging area for us.
Okay, tell us now where you landed specifically.
At Oro Bay.
Oro Bay, and you unloaded as a battalion?
Unloaded, and we went into a camp area.
Okay, at this time, what was your rank?
At that time, I was a private first class.
PFC, and you'd been in the Army a little over a year.
A little over a year.
And you're already overseas and girding up for contact
right
with the enemy. Okay, tell us what you did from the time you landed.
The time I landed, I'd become into battalion headquarters. I was asked by the tech sergeant in charge of the personnel section, if I'd like a job in their position. So I said, fine, because when I had finished basic training and during the training in the United States, I was a what they call a basic. I had no special training, no specialist. I was a non-specialist. So I said, yes, that sounds pretty good.
What were they asking you to do?
They were asking me to be come into the personnel section to be just simply a record keeper for them.
For the battalion?
For the battalion.
Okay. At this point, were you aware that you were working for Douglas MacArthur, or where you were, or what you were supposed to do?
Yes, I knew that command was, that Southwest Pacific was under Douglas MacArthur. We knew there was a preparatory time we were going to go through before they would use us.
And you knew now you were in New Guinea.
Yes.
And were you shown maps and said, this is your objective, this is where we're going to go?
No.
We just were took there. Took a day at a time.
Day at a time. That's about the best way to describe it.
Okay. When you're in personnel now.
Right.
What were the guys doing who were driving the tanks? And
they were further training. They started to train more with infantry units. And of course, they had they were in range, kind of quite a bit of time in ranges firing their weapons. I'd done that in the United States, but now I was in this position where I was free from that.
Can you comment on that? The fact that the United States Army up till they landed in New Guinea didn't think tanks belonged in the South Pacific very much.
No, they simply, it was a small use of them in the Pacific overall up to that point. I think New Guinea was at, all the New Guinea battles at that time, they had one tank battalion perhaps supporting all those units. They simply used them in segments, platoons and companies.
I think the first airport that was captured was a small island just to the north of New Guinea, and that was the first use of the tanks. But I don't know if it was the 75th.
That's, no, we weren't involved in that.
That was not
no,
you.
I think there was a unit 706 was involved in the New Guinea campaign.
What did I ask you at all in here? What was the number of your battalion?
No, I don't think so.
Okay,
775th Tank Battalion.
It was you?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, we weren't involved in the New Guinea battles.
Okay. All righty. How long were you at this particular place before you started to move?
We were there till, December of 1944.
Okay, and you're kind of, everybody is starting to move up toward the tip and then move
right,
out of
the,
there.
They're on the brink of moving into the Philippines.
Now, how did you hear about what was going on in the rest of the war?
As I said before, I can't remember much information from the rest of the war. There was no news of any sort to us. Because we didn't have individual radios.
No Stars and Stripes, nothing?
I don't remember newspaper.
You sound like an abandoned unit here.
Yeah, we were a battalion, I guess, a little account.
Okay, you're moving into the first of the new year. Is that correct?
Right.
45.
Yeah, we're being embarked for use in Luzon.
Were you talking to anybody who had been further along in combat, and they're coming back to you and saying this is what's happening around you?
No, not at all. I don't remember anybody.
All right. So they loaded you up, or they prepared you to move to the Philippines.
Right.
Okay. Now tell us about that, because that's a good stretch too.
Yeah, they loaded us on the LST, the landing ship tank.
Yeah.
At Oro Bay. And we moved up the coast slowly, I guess, to gain other components for the convoy. I think we spent 2 or 3 days on Olandia, which is farther up the coast from Oro Bay.
So you were no longer a single ship sailing?
No, we were sailing as a group, as a convoy.
How big a convoy was it?
I don't think it was over large, if I remember right.
What capital ships did you have?
I think all we had was destroyers.
Destroyers?
I think by that time the air power over the Japanese air power over the Luzon was destroyed, and they could operate with lesser ships.
Did they tell you specifically you were headed for the Philippine Islands?
Yes, they did. specifically for Luzon.
While you were there, before you left New Guinea, were you aware of airfields being built around you or any of the constructions going on?
They'd been largely left behind. There was a larger one near us called, very well known in New Guinea, called Debaduro. And that had been abandoned as they moved up the coast. In fact, we used some of the materials for our tent floors, the metal bases of the used metal
sheets,
mats. We used those for flooring. So the Debaduro was largely abandoned, I think, at that time. They'd moved farther up the coast, their air bases.
Okay. And on what particular date, if you can remember, did you sail off for the Philippine Islands?
December 1944. Late in the month. I think I remember spending my birthday at Islandia. That was the 22nd. So we were there. We were between the 22nd and the beginning of January, we're at sea.
And how long were you at sea?
About between 7 and 9 days before we approached Luzon. And
all right, now tell us about this. You're going into conflict really right up against it now.
Yeah, we were going in on what they called, D plus two. I don't know if they use D anymore, but it was the second day.
Yeah.
And the beaches were abandoned. The Japanese had changed their strategy of meeting you on the beach.
They waited to get you inland.
Inland, yes.
Yeah. I've got that Douglas MacArthur landed on the 9th at Luzon, and you were 100 miles from Manila. Was you part of that, or did you see anything of that?
No, we didn't engage in the Manila battle. We engaged in the Battle of Northern Luzon.
Okay,
in the mountains.
Tell us about that, being in Luzon now.
Well, we turned up into the mountains. After we landed, we turned left into the mountains. And we had to set up a headquarters at a town called Asingan.
Would you spell that?
A-S-I-N-G-A-N.
Asingan.
Asingan. It was a small Filipino town. They had a piazza, a large church, and an open-air market. It was a basic Philippine town. And from there, we sent out units to support the infantry divisions facing the Japanese in the mountains of northern Luzon, in the Bleedy Pass area, in the Baguio Front. And we used those, we supported an entire Army Corps with one battalion of tanks. That's how limited their use were. They could use them on the roads, and sometimes they surprised the Japanese by managing to get up on some good heights. But overall, we never engaged the enemy as a total unit, only separately.
But with a 90 millimeter gun, you're talking.
No, at that time they still had the 90 millimeter gun came in the preparation for the Japanese attack. We still had the
75s, but that was adequate. Portable artillery.
Yes, it was. It was portable artillery. That's what they really. We had a platoon of 105 millimeters mounted on tank chassis, which were very useful up there. And we had a platoon of 81 millimeter mortars on half tracks.
Herb, were you now in combat with the enemy?
Only in the opening phases, only in the landing on the beaches.
Okay, tell us please about that.
Well, when we came on the beach, it was near nightfall, and they were so sure of the non-activity of the Japanese Air Force, they lit all the LSTs. So that night, I think, was the first enemy activity when they started to shell the beach. They had hidden gun positions up on the on the left of us, in the high ground. And they intermittently shell you during the night, which was, I guess, the large caliber shells. I was told that they were guns that were taken out of the American defenses of Manila they were using. So that was the first inkling of we had of combat.
You're under fire now, and it's night, and you're in a faraway place.
It's very disturbing.
Get more specific. What is it like to be in that situation?
I think you really don't want to expect. At that point, we were in sand, so we could dig some sort of a hole very easily. Later, when we went into the countryside, the ground was like rock, very difficult to dig in. And you can only dig, and if you had an afternoon to dig, you can only dig a very shallow hole. But that opening phase of it was, for someone that had never experienced combat except in stories, it was very, very disturbing.
Now, as you moved in off the beach, I take it it's because the Japanese were moving away from you.
Right.
Was your unit actively pursuing them?
Yes, they split the units up very quickly and went to the these various infantry divisions to support them. And we were then, as I said, we went into that town and that became our battalion headquarters, mm-hmm. actually for the entire Battle of Northern Luzon. That was our headquarters.
Okay. Are you able to tell us some of the numbers of some of the units around you? The divisions?
Right. The 43rd, the 37th, the 33rd, the 6th, the 25th, and I think the 158th Regimental Combat Team for a time. They shuttled the division sometimes, withdrew some units from the Northern Luzon to aid in the fight for the other islands and for Manila. But I remember that first night on the beach with the shells coming over, and I think when there was a hole, there was an immediate filling of it by more than one. Because I think there was no shells really landed near us. They landed on the beach. I think they landed more in the sea than they did on the beach.
And you suspect they were shooting at the ships?
They were shooting at the lights. I think that's the only guidance they had.
This is a larger question, but what caused these people to turn on lights when they're under fire?
I don't know. Maybe they put them out at that time because we were up on the beach. But they were so confident there was no air power and there was no enemy within reach, they thought.
Okay, you weren't wounded.
No.
No, I'm glad to know that. On one of your papers I read just before this, were you in contact with other units from, say, the Australians or New Zealanders?
We only saw the Australians in New Guinea. Not as, I think their units had moved up the coast. We only see the service units, and they had their government. There was a unit that governed the New Guinea Australian. If you wanted contract labor, you'd go through the Australians for it.
What was your opinion of these other nationals?
I thought the Australians were very good because I knew something about the Australians. I had an uncle in Australia. He lived there after leaving Ireland. And I thought they were a pretty good
pretty
group
decent
of guys.
People, aren't they?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Pretty forthright.
And how about the United States Air Force or the Navy? What was over your head at this time?
At that time, I think at the Lingayen Gulf where we landed, the Navy were very active in supporting fire from the ships and also the air power. We were very closely supported by Corsairs, which maybe belonged to you, to the Marines and the Navy. They provided very good close support over the beaches and the and into the outlying mountain areas.
Did you see any of that, the attacks by planes?
I seen them at the beach. They were moving inland. You could see them. We'd come over very low levels. But I don't remember them afterwards.
And how about?
I was in battalion headquarters in that town.
Okay. How about the big ships? Did you see any of those?
I don't think there was any many large ships left by that D2. They had withdrawn, and there was basically destroyers.
You talked about this little Philippine town you were in.
Right.
Did you mix with or have anything to do with the locals, the Filipinos?
Oh, yes, we did mix with them.
Tell us about that.
They're very very friendly people. Of course, and there was the profit motive. There was an army unit near them, and there was a washerwoman. Yeah. There was various tradesmen that were looking to buy anything, even your clothes. And we sold, I think, all our underwear except for our undershorts. And I asked the Filipino, I said, what do you do? Is this, what's your occupation? He said, I buy and sell.
Buys and sells. Did you speak Spanish or did they speak English?
There was once who could speak English. In fact, there was a teacher, a woman teacher in the town, who speak excellent English. But it was a country agricultural town. We appropriated the common. They had a large, an excellent common with crosswalks, cement crosswalks. And I think there might have been a fountain in the center. And that was our initial encampment there. And later we moved into the large open air market and bamboo walled it and made it into a headquarters.
We spoke of your clothing a moment ago. Was it adequate for the climate you were in?
Outside of the gas proofing of the clothing, we soon got rid of that. And before we left, they gas proofed the fatigues, and they were very uncomfortable. So after they washed, we made ourselves comfortable. We tried to wear as little as possible.
What did gas proofing do to the clothing? Made it heavier, less porous?
Less porous. Made it just too hot for that climate.
But so you guys adapted quartermaster didn't think about.
We washed it out.
Yeah.
They went the way of the gas mask.
Tell us about the kind of terrain you were in. You said the fighting was taking
place
in the mountains.
The fighting was in the mountainous terrain, extremely mountainous. Those northern mountains of Luzon are to the tank are only open to the roads. And the attack in Baguio, that's where they principally fought, was on the road leading into Baguio. And in the Bleedy Pass, they were faced with just a gravel road. And they, as I said, they did bring tanks into some very crazy places to fire in. And they were very successful in doing that as close-in artillery.
Were your tanks firing at blockhouses or other tanks?
Very few other tanks. They had been destroyed very early in the battle for northern Luzon. No, we were firing at cave positions, mm-hmm. mostly. In those mountains, they really didn't need blockhouses. They dug out caves and operated
from them. And they were supported by a platoon or two squads of infantry with them?
With the tank?
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, they were well supported by infantry. Of course, at night they withdraw to a perimeter themselves, and during the daytime they'd have their daily operations, what they had to do.
When you were in this little town that you described to us, did you feel at any time it was subject to attack?
Only maybe an air attack. I don't think it was no subject to an infiltration.
No banzai charges or anything
like
that.
In fact, I think that there's a section there for the funniest thing that happened to you. That's when we had a special services sergeant, in charge of entertainment for the battalion. We got up in the bright moonlight, and the Japanese used a lone plane to rattle you at night. Washing machine Charlie.
He was all over the Pacific, wasn't
he? Right. This fellow started dancing on the bright moonlight on the cement walk and saying, I want to die dancing. He had a small chance of
About how long were you in this town?
We were there from right to the end of the war, till maybe September of 1945.
Okay, let me ask you one question first before we get back to that. Did you feel your officers gave you good leadership and were competent and knew what they were doing?
I think we had scattered results on that. We had the unit commander was dismissed and his executive officer from command of the battalion for the inadequacy of the training, I guess, and preparation. And the other officers were, for what I knew of them, what I heard and knew about them, there was scattered results for them. So in fact, we had an officer that was not considered for a promotion. when you went overseas, they upped him a grade. And he wasn't upped from second lieutenant to lieutenant. But he later won the Silver Star. Some of the good men were ignored for some of the ones that were poorer.
Is this a man you knew, this officer?
No, I didn't know him. I knew he was a line officer, a tank platoon commander. But I remember the story.
General Douglas MacArthur declared the liberation of the Philippines on the 4th of July in 1945. And you say you were there till the end of the war.
Right.
So you heard about in August of the bombing of Hiroshima.
That's another thing.
And Nagasaki.
Yeah, that's another thing. We never had any direct news of that. Once again, we were bereft of any news. When I heard it, I thought it was just another super bomb that developed. I didn't realize it was a new bomb, the atomic bomb. And it was, we were preparing at that time for we were going to be on the invasion of Kyushu.
Okay, that's my next, thank you. That's my next question. The war ended that is to say the Philippines were liberated. You guys were in the Philippines, and in parts of the Philippines, they were being prepared. I understand there were 38,000 hospital beds set aside, ready for the invasion of Kyushu and the other islands in Japan. Did you have any inkling at this time that you were going on and having to go to Japan?
Oh, yes, we were. That's when I said they changed the gun on the tank, and that was a clue. That they were going to, we were told we were going to be an invading force.
Tell us about that point, how you adapted your weapons to where you thought you were going.
That was the main adaption, was the 90mm gun to make it a better cannon.
Is it, since the war, you've done a lot of looking back, I'm sure. Is it true that where you were, was that terrain and the number of troops involved and where you were going were pretty much the same, that they drew parallels?
Between Japan and the Philippines?
Yeah, that Kyushu and...
Kyushu, I think, would, as I read later, would have been more difficult for us because there was, I think the ground was open and it was rice paddied. Kyushu, and I think it would have been much more difficult for us as a unit, a tank unit, they could bring more anti-tank fire on us in Japan than they would have even in the Philippines.
Mm-hmm. What other preparations did your unit make that you were aware of for the invasion of Japan?
Outside of that, I don't think there was any, and there was no more additional training at that time, because the end was in August, so... was the invasion, and I might have been for October. So
the 1st of November was...
The 1st of November?
Yeah.
And I don't remember any additional training at all.
But you had to do something mentally about this, didn't you?
Yes.
We're going to go on from here?
Going to go on from here.
How was that taken? You knew that the war in Europe had ended, and you thought, now here we're going on.
Right. I thought at one time I was going to be a colonist in the Pacific. I was going to be there nearly for all time. But I just thought it would be much more difficult for us, and there'd be many more casualties. Up to that time, we really had light casualties as a tank, as a unit.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought the Kyushu would be the maybe the undoing of us.
And I'm interested in what you've just said, that you heard about the two super bombs. But not that they were anything but large bombs.
Right. I didn't know they were this special bomb, this new bomb at all.
What did you hear specifically?
I didn't, as I said, we heard very little.
Just that there were these two big bombs.
Yes, yeah. And even that maybe came late. I don't know I can't remember when we heard that information, but I know it wasn't immediate.
Okay, yeah. August 14th, Japan surrenders.
Right.
And when you had first been drafted and gone into the armed forces, what were the terms of your commitment until you got all the points and could come home?
I think it was originally the your till the end of the war plus a certain number of months.
Plus 90 days 90 or something days, like that.
Or 6 months or something. But the points came later in, mm-hmm. after the close of the war. And I think some left early, some men had more points than others.
Were you ever given any rest or recreation, R&R, from your duties? Could you go any place and do anything?
We could go to the through the local area. Perhaps we never went into Manila, for example, even after it was liberated. We only go to local, perhaps to as far as Lingayen on the Gulf.
For the beaches, is that about
it? Not even
it?
In the beaches. There was no transportation for you except you were a driver and had a specific destination. You just couldn't, as an enlisted man, have a jeep at your disposal to.
Did any USO shows ever come to where you were?
I think I remember going to one with I thought it was Bob Hope in New Guinea. And maybe one in the Philippines. I'm not very little.
How much did you really know about the enemy you were going to face?
Very little. Very little about the enemy until you faced him.
And then?
I know he had a reputation for excess, actually for cruelty. And he had a different code of war than we did. Of course, we knew about Bataan, we knew about Hong Kong. So those were bad testament to what they were.
That was before you were in combat,
yes,
against them.
Right.
Did you, let me use the word, did you respect them as soldiers?
I respect them as for their fighting abilities, yes.
Yes.
Not for any human abilities they had. They were excellent fighters.
Did your opinion change before or after you were in combat?
I think it changed a bit after I was in combat.
In what way?
That they were excessive. These men were would do anything in a war.
I guess in the larger sense, we might have talked about this a minute ago, our equipment versus their equipment.
Much better.
Your equipment was much better.
The Japanese had inferior tanks. They had a conglomeration of artillery weapons that didn't, no unification in them. But as a tank unit, where there was no comparison with the Japanese tank, we were much better. They had the tanks were from the early 30s. They had never developed them any further. They were inefficient as a tank weapon.
Did you stop to think at any time that the German equipment was superior, at least at the beginning of the war, and the Japanese was inferior, that where you went was, again, the luck of the draw,
right,
considering what you were up against?
Yes, we would have existed for less time in France and Belgium than we would have in the Philippines. Because I said we had very light casualties, and I don't think we lost more than 5 tanks. Maybe some of them I know one by a terrible accident, by falling off into a ravine off a road near Baguio. But combat losses were very, very low.
Mm-hmm.
So it was for fighting an enemy, it was much more desirable than Europe.
Okay, the war is over. You're in the Philippines. Now what?
Now they say we're going to use you elsewhere. We're going to use you as a bring you down to Manila, and less all your equipment, except the jeeps, trucks.
Is this you collectively, the whole battalion?
The whole unit went as a one to Manila. You're becoming more or less a security unit. You're going to guard the equipment in and around Manila. And we just walked out of that Asingan, and walked out of northern Luzon, and left everything there, except what was we needed to be, have us move.
That's good for the guy who buys and sells things.
Oh, the guys with those wonderful tanks.
You're in Manila, and you're waiting around now, aren't you?
We're more or less waiting around, just guarding these. They're as quickly as possible, they're demobilizing. And of course, that point system came to being then, and our unit as a whole was about equivalent in points each. So we were going to be sent home as a unit.
Well, while you were there now and the war is over, did you get any opportunity to see some historic places like Corregidor or Bataan?
No,
or
we didn't. We didn't at all.
Hotels in Manila or anything
like
that?
No, it was
like
just
that.
A wrecked city to us. We didn't have a chance to, there was no tours. We never offered a chance to see any of those, except you would maybe initiate it on your own.
Yeah.
We just saw the wrecked city.
There are stories of the United States leaving an awful lot of equipment in the Philippines and elsewhere in the Pacific. Did you see any of that?
I only saw what we left. And I really, in Manila, of course, that was still there when we left Manila. We were still a guard unit up to that point when we left, so. Of course, we were told that by other people, other service people, that it was just being dumped. But just left in place.
Or driven off a cliff somewhere.
Yeah. Off a cliff, yeah.
How did you get home?
We were brought to an assembly camp below Manila, and we were sent home as a unit. We went home again in a better troop ship this time.
Non-stop again?
Non-stop again.
Nobody goes to Hawaii these days.
No one to Hawaii, no. We go right up over the northern, brought us up the northern tip of Luzon and straight across the Pacific to San Francisco, which was a great sight.
And when you pulled in there when? In 46?
We December of 1945.
45?
Yeah, the really late December of 1945. And we were brought back to where we'd started from, Camp Stoneman at Pittsburgh, California, the same camp we'd left.
Tell us about sailing under the Golden Gate Bridge.
It was wonderful.
What were your feelings about that?
I think I couldn't believe we were home again, that it was all over. I thought it was going to be a terribly long time out there in the Pacific. Because with no news, as I said, you really didn't have any idea how long this was going to be or what they were doing. And I think we come in and the Saratoga was there. She was sailing out.
Really?
And it was a great feeling to be home again.
Have you made an effort since then, over the intervening years, to catch up on what you missed by being there, to read the books to see what happened to you in the larger view?
I did. The United States Army publishes the United States Army in World War II, a series of books. I read through the ones on the Pacific there of Victory in Papua, mm-hmm. The Approach to the Philippines. There's one on Leyte, and there's one Victory in the Philippines. That's basically on Luzon. So the Army done an excellent job on filling all that information in. The writing varies from book to book, but overall it's excellent.
Were you shipped home to where? Where did you go from California?
We were shipped. We were flown home to New Jersey. To
Dix?
No, we were dropped off at an airport there. We were flown across the United States, and then we took a train up to Devens, where we were processed and discharged. So
How many of you are part of this group? Did the battalion lose guys as they went across the country?
Oh, they were dispersed.
Country?
They were sent to an airfield in Sacramento, mm-hmm. and they were dispersed by the where they came from.
When you got back to Devens, were there any of the original party that you had set out with?
No, nobody at all.
You were all alone
again. I was alone. Yes.
Tell us the day you were discharged.
I think January 1946, maybe about the 18th. I'd have to look it up.
Tell us about that day, your feelings. You're going to get out today.
That was sort of post-mortem.
Yeah.
We'd arrived and we were just, it was just a matter of waiting to get out. I managed to get a ride home. There was somebody being picked up. I had become acquainted with, and they dropped me off. And I think I came back to my father's store in Hyde Park and walked in through the door and said hello to him. And with him, of course, he'd seen other men come back, and he'd come back himself.
Yeah. And now you're wearing a ruptured duck. And
a ruptured duck, and all spruced up with new clothes.
Was there a most memorable experience in your whole career? It's something that stands out more than anything else.
Oh. I think that landing in the Philippines was the most an abrupt change in your life, when you were leaving a normal life and going into a life that was really endangered. I think that was the most memorable experience.
Do you think about that sometimes?
Not badly, no, because we didn't really receive any. If we were close engaged, it would have been even much, much harder. We're only engaged at night with the shelling. But that was, I think that was the, that defined the change from one life to another.
Mm-hmm. Have you shared this with your family?
Yes, they're very good about it. I've shared this, and I've shared, my father had much more experience than I did in a war. He was an infantryman, and I've shared both of it with my family.
That's very good, and I'm glad you're doing this today. Was there a most memorable character that you can think about?
A regular army man. He'd been in Hawaii. He'd served in various infantry divisions. He'd been in Louisiana maneuvers in the 1940s. Of course, his problem was alcohol. And he was just moved along from one unit to another. New Yorker, much of a New Yorker. He'd been a military policeman in the Louisiana maneuvers, and had sent units, missent them different directions. So he eventually landed with us, and once again he was a problem for the commanding officer of the unit, and he was moved on. But he was sent to an infantry unit in Luzon, and he won a Bronze Star.
He finally found a home.
Found a home. That's what he told me. He said, if I hadn't been in the Army, I'd have been in prison. We sent him, we made a collection. His entire pay was devoted to court-martial fines. So we collected money for him to send him home for his last furlough to New York, and he was arrested there and was sent back to us. But in the Luzon, they just couldn't put up with him anymore. They just want what other units had done. They sent him on to another one.
Have you seen him since the
war?
No,
I've never seen him since. No.
Ever heard from him?
Never heard from him. No. He was a fellow I don't think would write letters.
Yeah. Did you join any veterans organizations after you got discharged?
No, I didn't.
Any particular reason?
No, I think I'm not an association person. We have an association that I'm a member of, the 775th Tank Battalion Association. Of course, you're a distant member of it. They only get together for a yearly get together, and I haven't even been at one of those. I would say they've been last year. They were at Polk again, which I'm sorry I missed.
You missed Polk?
Not that much, but
no. What were your feelings you walked into your father's store that day at Hyde Park?
I was relieved. I was glad that this whole thing was over with. I thought I'd done what I'd been asked to do, and I'd done it without problems, and I'd finished my commitment.
How important to you was serving in the military?
I think it was good for me. Because you have to live collectively together. You have to be able to support each other. And I wish we could do that in society as we did in the military. You couldn't get away from living together. Cooperation was essential.
In that sense then, it affected the rest of your life?
It did, yes.
Your outlook?
Yeah. I was made fun of for saying to my children, you've got to think and act collectively.
What did you think then And what do you think now about the war you were involved in?
I think it would, there was no, I feel no shame about that war or bad feelings about it, that we'd served in it. I think it was a necessary war for the entire world. And I was glad I was able to play a small part in it, even as a part of a battalion headquarters, which I was very lucky to be in.
Have you given any thought, Herb, to the difference in public opinion regarding the reception you got when you came home and the greetings that were in front of guys from Korea or Vietnam?
I really didn't realize at that time. I guess we had some local people that knew us would be happy to see us again, but I didn't notice any broad, you know, outpouring from the citizenry, that our neighbors and my friends and my relatives would be glad to see you home. But outside, I don't remember any large-scale demonstration of when I come home.
How about for the greetings that the Korean guys got or the Vietnam War guys got?
I thought I was always neutral about that. I thought they would expect to get that greetings in any war. You don't really, no one's going to slap you on the back. And because I can remember my father telling me, you can't expect that. In fact, he was, when he came back to Northern Ireland on a being wounded, they jeered him because he had volunteered. It wasn't necessary to volunteer in Ireland. They said, you know, you're foolish. You shouldn't be in a war. So I didn't think, I don't think you could expect much approbation after a war. You've just served in it, and that's it.
Since your discharge and up to now, did you ever receive any veterans benefits, as they're called, hospitalization or the GI Bill or insurance or something like that?
Well, I had the insurance policy, which was excellent.
Yeah.
It still is. It's a wonderful policy. And I had a house. I bought the house under the GI Bill, my present home. And I had, but that's what the use I made of it was. It was a wonderful country to be able to do that for you. I know my father got nothing. In fact, he owed money at the, he was able to draw money ahead of time, and he left with a debt to the British Army and never got anything else.
Did he ever pay it?
No. Didn't have to.
Good for him. Herb, is there any one thought, memory that you would like to share with us or your family that we haven't talked about this morning?
Outside of what I've said, I don't think there's much more. That you should try and make this thing work, this society work as much as you can. That you should all act together. That's about the best thing I can tell them to do. And not to engage in too many wars.
We thank you very much for coming in today.
Thank you, John.
You've been a very good guy to come in and tell us about your life, and yeah, we appreciate it very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.